You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the State Department of Justice is filing a lawsuit aimed at blocking Wisconsin's 1849 law that bans almost all abortions. We'll talk with Attorney General Josh Call about the legal challenge. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade was not the only big ruling to come out over the last week. The justices also released decisions in a pair of cases that set precedent on religion and public schools. First, they struck down a Maine law that prevented taxpayer dollars from funding tuition for religious schools as part of a program that helped people in rural areas without local schools pay the cost of private schools. Then the court ruled that a high school football coach could be allowed to pray on the field after games. In those cases, players and others gathered around him during the prayers. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you view the separation between church and state and how it plays out, especially in issues affecting public schools? Do you support the idea of using public dollars in some cases to pay religious school tuition? Do you think school authorities, school employees should be allowed to pray on school grounds? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is professor of political science and legal studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I gave very capsule headline summaries of both those cases. Let's pick them apart a little more. Let's start with this newest ruling on a high school football coach. The court ruled that a school couldn't prevent him from doing these prayers on the 50-yard line after games. We see images of people gathered around him. Can you talk more about that case and what the Supreme Court decided?
Sure. It's really a strikingly radical change in the rules about religion in schools, but to understand why, one has to dig into it fairly closely. So for a long time, there have been two principles that governed how the Establishment Clause works in the school context. One is that children are vulnerable. So things that we might allow adults to do, the classic example is prayers at legislative sessions or prayers when a court opens up the session, those might be okay because we expect that adults who don't share the religious belief of the prayer won't feel somehow pressed or coerced to act as though they do or feel that they ought to. But historically, for at least 50 years, we've said that children has been always defined to include anyone up to the end of high school, are vulnerable. If they see their teachers or their school administrators leading prayers or engaging in religious activities or promoting religion, we worry that the students will experience this as a kind of coercion to try and make them want to join that religion. One thing that's really striking about this opinion in Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, which is the case that you're talking about, is that that distinction is completely absent. In writing the opinion, Alito relied on cases involving adults, and particularly a case called Town of Greece versus Galloway, involving prayers at legislative sessions. And in that case, there's all kinds of discussion about how adults are different from children. That distinction simply disappeared and isn't mentioned at all. The second really striking thing here is that, as you mentioned, anyone who's followed this case at all in the news has seen these photographs of dozens of players in uniform, kneeling on the 50-yard line with a crowd around them. That's not how the court described events. The court described events as the coach taking a knee all by himself, away from the students, praying in silence. In other words, it was a blatantly, I don't know how else to say this, dishonest description of the facts and circumstances designed to create a scenario that would enable them to say that the school was suppressing this coach's exercise of his free speech and religious free exercise rights. And the third thing that's very, very striking about this case is the thing I just mentioned, the way it combines free exercise and free speech to argue that school teachers, coaches, and presumably other public officials, but specifically school teachers and school employees, have a combined right of free expression and free exercise, and that when those two rights combine, they become exceptionally strong, and that's what protects this public act of prayer by a school official during the school hours, while on duty, while around students. So all three of those points that I just mentioned are just complete departures from easily 50 years of jurisprudence in this area and signal a very, very radical turn toward allowing, if not requiring, a much greater presence for religious expression and religious, I don't want to say indoctrination, but let's say encouraging religiosity in public school settings.
An argument is a kid isn't required to go up and kneel around the coach. Say in this instance, they could stay on the sidelines, talk to their friends, whatever. What do you make of that? That's a response I've seen anyway. It's not coercion. It's voluntary.
Sure. So again, this is not a new issue. The most famous case of this had to do with prayers at a high school graduation. And again, for not quite 50 years, in this case, it's merely 40 years or 30 years. For 30 years, there's been a well-established proposition that say that where young people are concerned, especially school children, we're likely to find coercion in situations where we might not find it in the case of adults. And so we recognize the social pressure might be placed on students to participate in religious activity. In this case, there was more. The school district reported hearing complaints that students felt that if they didn't participate in the prayers, they wouldn't get playing time. And journalists who spoke to students heard from them directly that they felt that the coach wouldn't favor them on the field if they didn't participate in these prayer exercises, and that at least some of them said they did so unwillingly in order to remain in good graces with the coach. Confronted by this argument, the court's attitude was, well, that's only hearsay. We don't have real evidence of that, and so we're not going to consider the question. As I say, the justices in the majority really dramatically rewrote the facts to create a set of situations that would enable them to say that none of the traditional tests that have governed religion in schools should apply here, and then turned around and made a rule that arguably undercuts all those earlier rules altogether. So the question is, in a future case, if there really is evidence of coercion, let's leave aside the question of what happened here. Suppose in a future case, a coach says to prayers, you can't play unless you join my prayers. You know, what will a court do then? The way the Supreme Court handled the facts in this case, you might think it's easy to say, aha, this is different. This one has coercion and that one didn't, right? That is, accepting the facts on their face as presented by the majority. The problem is that the new explanation of the rules involved governing the conduct of teachers is such that it's very unclear how the Establishment Clause would limit those activities at all. The other question is that coercion is not the only standard under the Establishment Clause. Until, well, yesterday, there's also been a rule that public endorsement of religion, that is, public declarations that citizens or students in particular in schools who are members of a certain religion are more fully appreciated as citizens than those who are not, or that religious affiliation has something to do with citizenship or with the status of a student or with being a student in a school. That was separate from coercion. That was viewed as a violation of the Establishment Clause. That's simply off the table. That entire theory of endorsement has been abolished by this one decision. And even beyond that, you'll notice I'm emphasizing the radicalness of this decision that I intend to. A case that goes back to the 1970s called Lemon versus Kurtzman, which was just a general overall framework for considering Establishment Clause questions, has also been overruled. And what's most striking is that in the opinion, the court simply says, well, we're not overruling it. We're simply assuming this case had effectively been overruled before, and we expected everyone to know that. It's a very strange opinion that way. It's very unusual, not to say unheard of, for the court to say a major precedent was overruled even though we never said so. And you, the lower courts, and you, the public, are simply expected to have understood that at some point in the last 30 years. And we're now declaring going forward, not that we need to overrule that case, it simply isn't a precedent anymore. It is not a precedent anymore, and let's go forward from here. It's a wildly sweeping decision that goes much further than it needed to resolve this case, and does so in a way that formally announces that the Establishment Clause is dramatically weakened and has dramatically less force than it did last week.
Talking to Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison about two U.S. Supreme Court decisions on religion and public schools. Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. Josh is with us in Mineral Point. Josh, hi.
Yes, I mean, I understand the difference between church and state and everything else, but What would we got a bunch of white Christians in the Supreme Court now. What's the difference if someone by the name of Ali put a prayer blanket down at the end of the field and started praying? Would the Supreme Court have overturned it then?
Josh, thanks for the call. Howard, I know this is a question I've seen other people bring up. Would non-Christians trying to do something similar enjoy similar protections?
My assumption is yes. Now, the caveat there is the point I made earlier about, I think I misspoke, Gorsuch wrote the opinion, how he manipulated the facts. So there's always the possibility that if we have a future case with, let us say, a Muslim football coach who, as the caller says, puts down his prayer rug and prays at the 50-yard line. You know, a court will find a way to distinguish that case on the facts somehow. But more generally, this court is perfectly happy, and these, as the caller says, white Christian justices are perfectly happy to allow religious expression in general, because they understand that in this country, the vast majority of the time, that's going to be Christian expression. In other words, it's a version of neutrality that says we will accept all religions equally, and we will pay no attention to the fact that some religions are much more majoritarian than others in our particular society, and that it is much, much more likely that a non-Christian student will be made to feel isolated by public displays of Christian worship than the opposite.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to UW-Madison political science professor Howard Schwaber about church and state and public schools in the wake of two new U.S. Supreme Court rulings, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think state tax money should be used to support religious schools in some instances? When yes, when no? Do you think school officials should be allowed to publicly hold prayers on school grounds, to lead prayer circles, for example? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your comments or your questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison political science professor Howard Schwaber. With us today, looking at the legal impact of two recent U.S. Supreme Court rulings over funding religious schools and prayer at a public high school. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. Howard, before we go back to our callers, let's visit Maine now, this other case that led to a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on funding by the state for religious schools. What happened there?
So this is a case that follows up on a series of previous cases over the last few years, dealing with the question of when a state or whether a state may provide funding for some private school activities and not others. Specifically, Maine had a law that said that in rural areas where there was a lack of access to public schools, state funds could be used for parents to send children to private schools. The law had a restriction that said those funds could not be used to send children to religious private schools. Chief Justice Roberts, writing for the majority, said that this is a discrimination against religion. Maine argued that it was not, and that the difference was that the secular private schools offered the same education as the public schools, whereas religious private schools were offering something different, and that was a fair basis for distinction. But Roberts rejected that argument. He said to distinguish between religious private schools and secular private schools is simply discrimination against religion and is impermissible. Therefore, if Maine, and by extension any other state, wants to provide funding for use in any private schools, it must allow those funds to be used in religious private schools. And if I can go back to a point the caller made on the previous case, that will apply equally to Christian schools and Muslim schools and Jewish schools and any other school that is recognized as a religious private school.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Conrad is with us in Platteville. Conrad, hi.
Yeah, I think schools pass state education standards that people's money that they supposedly contribute to the state for education of their own children or their grandchildren or whoever's children should be able to go to any school in that state that meets those standards.
Conrad, thanks a lot for that call. So Howard, I believe Maine had tried to set a standard that that those schools couldn't include a religious indoctrination. I don't know if that's the word they used, but religious instruction. So this ruling would seem to say, no, a state can't set that standard.
That's correct. So, I mean, your caller's point is certainly well taken. As long as the school is providing an education, who cares who is providing the education? The answer is, at least in the past, we used to care about what else the school might be doing. So you can go all the way back to the writings of James Madison, when he wrote his famous essay in Virginia. And he said, it is a crime against conscience to ask someone to contribute tax dollars to be used to promulgate and promote a faith that he doesn't believe in. The problem is not that the religious schools in question are not providing education. The argument was they're also doing something else, which is proselytizing a religion, and public funds shouldn't be used for that purpose, because one person's money shouldn't be used, in this Madisonian notion, to promote a faith in which they do not believe. The Roberts Court has now rejected that principle. and said that the fact that these schools may be engaged in promoting faith and proselytizing or anything else doesn't matter. Those are separate from the fact that they function as schools. In a way, the Roberts Court is taking the same view as our caller. It says as long as they're providing an education, the state has no good basis for excluding them based on what else they might be doing.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Looking at two U.S. Supreme Court cases on religion and public schools with Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison. Still time for your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You mentioned that the first case we talked about prayer on the football field there, very wide in scope, that ruling with this main school funding one. Do you see this as having a wide scope that's going to affect a lot of other, for example, state school funding laws?
Oh, absolutely. And the two cases go together. So the football coach prayer case weakens the Establishment Clause in the sense it drastically reduces the restrictions that the Establishment Clause places on what is acceptable behavior by public teachers and other public officials. The main case is called Carson versus Macon, weakens a different Establishment Clause principle, which is one that would have until now prohibited using public money for the direct teaching of religion to children, or at least permitted states to refuse to use money to be used that way. What the two cases have in common is they both dramatically weaken the Establishment Clause. And when I say that, I mean in comparison to what it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago. The Establishment Clause, like all constitutional provisions, undergoes evolution over time, and the doctrines have shifted over time. But for at least 50 years, we have said that the use of public money to promulgate religion directly, and particularly to do so in schools, is a line that should not be crossed and is prohibited by the Establishment Clause. This is the latest in a series of cases. There were others in the last couple of 3 years that have removed that restriction and caused the Establishment Clause to become that much weaker. At the same time, the treatment of the football coach emphasizes how much the free exercise clause has been strengthened and has been connected to the free speech clause. So the whole balance, right? Separation of church and state is a slogan. In practice, it's always a matter of striking a balance between public roles and government actions and religious authorities and churches. And that balance has shifted pretty dramatically in the last 3 days, like 3 or 4 days.
Let's go back to our callers now. Pam is with us in Bagley. Pam, hello.
Hi, I am interested in both of the cases and wondering what happens. It seems like it's a slippery slope. Wonder what happens when we have a teacher or a coach who's identifying as a Satanist and wants to bring that religion into the football field or into the classroom. And can we support dollars going to a Satanist?
Pam, thanks for the call. And go ahead, Howard. Yeah.
Sorry. The short answer is yes, we will have to. It is not permissible to have a principle like this and apply it only to some religion. In fact, there's already been an instance, I cannot recall where, but of Satanists organizing to hold events on football fields in response to this, not the Supreme Court case, but after this controversy arose. Absolutely, we will have to allow Satanists or any other religion that one can name or make up to partake of the same freedom. And this has always been the problem. It's really important, though, I think, to remember that the reason for the Establishment Clause and the separation of church and state and all this rhetoric, all this way of thinking about the idea that we ought to keep religion out of politics has to do with the fear of majoritarian tyranny. Again, going all the way back to James Madison, the concern was that the majority religion would use its ability to become influential over public affairs to impose its agenda and to oppress or suppress members of minority religions. And so, you know, the danger of Satanists holding prayers on a football field is that it might be shocking or perhaps offensive. The argument is, or the argument was until this week, that the danger of having Christian prayers on a football field is different. It has the capacity to make everyone feel that if they're not Christian, they're not part of the mainstream society and not fully members of the community. That's not really a risk with prayers being conducted by Satanists. But that whole concern about majoritarian domination that was at the heart of the creation of the Establishment Clause at the founding has essentially been written out of that clause by the Roberts Court.
Thanks for that call, Pam. We'll go to Jimmy in Valley Junction now. Jimmy, hi.
Hello, gentlemen. Yeah, I was a little confused when I read the main decision. Well, when I heard about it, it seemed like the money was going right to the school. But when I read the decision, it looks like it goes to the parents, and then the parents made the decision to send the kid to parochial school. And I don't know if there's other options for the parents or if that was the only school they had.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Does it matter if it's a voucher type thing like that, Howard, where state money goes to a parent and then they make the decision on a religious school?
The answer is it does. And that's not new. That goes back to the early 2000s. The term is intervening private choice. So the idea is maybe we're concerned about the state giving money directly to religious schools, but that concern is obviated if the money goes to parents, then parents make a private choice about what schools to attend. The criticisms of that theory are that very often the only religious schools that are eligible for the funds are Christian schools and usually Catholic schools because of support for those schools from the Catholic establishment, which is there is no equivalent establishment for Muslim or Protestant or Jewish or Hindu schools to fund their existence. The other question is, and I think the caller nailed it really when he said, what if there's no other alternative? And that's exactly right. That is, if a religious school opens in an area where, and remember, this was a program directed at rural education, in a rural area where the nearest alternative is far, so that it's at least much easier to go to the religious school, then you have a draw, a reason that would encourage parents who might not even share that necessarily that faith to send their students to that school. The problem with all of these arguments, such as the intervening private choice, there are two problems, excuse me. One is it's a formalistic argument. It's like the old joke, if the missiles go up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, as a line from a song once said. If we know where the money is going, the fact that we funnel it through parents, does that obviate the concerns that led to the creation of the Establishment Clause in the first place? And the second problem is that if there is a lack of other alternatives, then this becomes effectively something that looks a little bit coercive. And for both of those reasons, traditionally, prior to very recent times, these laws would have been upheld.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. With us today, looking at separation of church and state after two Supreme Court rulings related to religious issues and public schools around the country.